Welcome to the fourth Oxford Institute for Energy Studies podcast. My name is David Ledesma, and I am Senior Fellow at the Institute. I'm today joined by Professor Jonathan Stern, founder of and distinguished fellow of the Oxford Institute for Energy Studies Natural Gas Programme, to discuss the future of gas. Welcome, Jonathan.
Thank you very much.
Nice to see you.
Very nice to be here.
Now, Jonathan, you've authored two papers on the subject. First was The Future of Gas in Decarbonising European Energy Markets, The Need for a New Approach. And you did that in January 2017.
Yep.
And recently, you've published The Challenges to the Future of Gas, Unburnable or Unaffordable, in December 2017. So why don't we start this discussion by asking, what drove you to write the first paper, and what has the reaction been to it?
Okay, well, at a conference that you and I were at in April 2016, I was listening to a whole lot of gas people tell us how gas was a transition and destination fuel, how it was the future of the low-carbon economy, and watching 1,000 people nodding wisely and thinking, this is all nonsense. Nobody yeah. really believes this. We've got to write something hopefully sensible about the future of gas. Yeah. And trying to get some general agreement among the community about what do we really think the future of gas is. And I think of the first paper where I essentially said, you know what, this is a fossil fuel, and if fossil fuels are going to be phased out, that means gas as well. Mm-hmm. Basically, people agreed with that.
Interesting. Okay, so in that paper, you say that the European gas community has been arguing that it can play a major role in the whole transition and the decarbonisation of energy markets because of the whole advantage of moving from coal to gas. But you also say that this argument is not relevant, and it's also been unsuccessful in gaining acceptance of policymakers or the environmental community, and it's even not even applicable in some countries. So what do you mean by this?
Well, really what I mean is that the gas community spent a long time talking to itself and convincing itself that it had great arguments, but it didn't really convince anybody else.
We're good at doing that.
We're very good at doing it.
Yeah.
But the problem is we need to get out more. We need to talk to people outside our own community. And the difficulty is that the coal to gas argument is fine, but for a lot of countries it doesn't work. And for a lot of countries, they take the view coal means security, imported gas means dependence on Russia, and we don't want that. Mm-hmm. And we're not addressing those arguments. We're also not addressing the fact that renewables have made much more progress than anyone ever thought over the last 5 years. Mm-hmm. So really the question is, are we really talking sense, and who are we addressing?
That's a good point. So therefore, what are the key variables which are going to determine the long-term future of gas in Europe? You know, do we need a carbon pricing regime that works, and how applicable would this be in other regions of the world?
Well, you know, Europe is a very different place to other regions of the world, and I would argue that Northwest Europe is actually quite different to the rest of Europe. But the carbon...
Why do you say that?
Well, principally because Northwest Europe is wildly carbon-centric. Mm-hmm. The only thing that matters in Northwest Europe as far as energy policy is concerned is carbon. Now, if you go to Central Eastern Europe, if you go to Southeastern Europe, that is not the case.
Mm-hmm.
Basically, what those guys are thinking about are much more what the rest of the world is thinking about, which is pricing and what they call security, which means import dependence.
Mm-hmm.
In Northwest Europe, everything is about carbon, and this is a real problem about our mindset in terms of our policymakers, our young people, but also our media. What we have to be aware of is that the rest of the world doesn't think like that. And this is where the second paper became important, because as I moved outside Europe, nobody was talking to me about carbon until I arrived in Australia or Japan. the whole of the Asian land mass, you go to Latin America, you go to Africa, nobody talks to you about carbon. If you say to them, but you've signed up for COP21, they say, oh, yes, we've done that. And then they start talking to you about other things.
Right. So therefore, you know, is there going to be, do you think, a carbon pricing regime required in Europe? Or is it going to...
Well, there is a carbon pricing regime already. It hasn't produced a price high enough to have a meaningful effect, except in countries like the UK, yes, where we have the carbon floor price. Yeah. Yes, fine. But the big question, and you know, why has gas done well in 2016 and 2017 until the current winter? It's because gas prices became cheap and coal prices became expensive. It's the old chestnut of what does it make sense to use from an economic point of view?
Yeah. So, okay, let's just talk about Europe for a minute. I think in your second paper, we'll discuss more the kind of global aspects of it. But, you know, you say that there's certainly been a lack of traction on the whole industry's gas advocacy message. And to ensure a post-2030 future in European energy balances, the gas community will have to adopt a new message. Gas can decarbonise and be competitive. Honestly, can that really be the case?
Well, that's what I proposed in the first paper. But the interesting reaction from the community when I tried that out on them is that basically no. Methane cannot be decarbonised on a large scale. We don't believe that carbon capture and storage will work on a large scale. We think it's too expensive and it requires cooperation across the value chain that we don't currently see. Now, if you don't believe that methane can be decarbonised on a large scale, what are you left with? Yeah. Well, you're left with the possibility of biogas and biomethane and also power to gas. But is that going to actually produce the kind of size of gas market we have in Europe today? No, it isn't.
But isn't it? You insinuate it's a technology game there, that we need the next step of technology to be able to achieve gas as being not as a kind of a fuel that's seen as dirty.
We need several next steps in technology, and we don't yet see, at least on the scale that would be required, that happening. And that's a very important thing for the community to realise, mm-hmm. because it means what about infrastructure? What's the length of time that infrastructure can survive before demand goes down? And it also means, is it worth producing, trying to find and produce gas to deliver to the European market? And that's something that both Europeans and non-Europeans have to focus on.
Yeah, one of the things, this comes on also to the kind of the whole gas value chain cooperation, because you also say that the paradigm shift in the commercial time horizons and that chain will be necessary for industry to embrace the technologies which we just talked about, such as carbon capture and storage, and eventually it'll be necessary for the European gas markets. But I don't understand yet how this will be achieved. You know, does the EU or domestic governments support, or just can the market deliver? So is it going to be regulatory delivered or driven, I mean, or is it going to be driven by the market?
I don't think it will be delivered by regulation. It's partly because there isn't enough consensus in either governments or regulatory authorities that gas should be made a larger part of the future. What the industry has to do, if it wants to have a really good future post-2030, is to reorganise itself in a way that the value chain actually delivers the fuel at a lower cost. That is going to be what makes gas either last much longer than 2030 or essentially be in decline post-2030.
Yeah. Well, it's interesting because that's one of the points I'll come to in the next paper about whose responsibility is to get that lower cost, because I think that's a bit of a challenge. I think to a certain extent the technology providers being sick of people beating them over the heads for lower costs. But I'll come to that in a minute. But let's just jump at the end of this discussion on the first paper to the conclusion. And what I'd like to do for the listeners of this podcast is just read that conclusion, because I found it very blunt, if I may. And that is, so the conclusion was, the European gas community must adopt a new approach to its future in decarbonising energy markets. Specifically, it needs to devise and implement a strategy which will lead to the decarbonisation of methane starting no later than 2030. Failure to do so will be to accept a future of decline, albeit on a scale of decades, and to risk that by the time the community engages with decarbonisation, non-methane policy options will have to be adopted, which will make that decline irreversible. And I think also, you know, that's the negative. Your paper also concludes that it's not all doom and gloom in Europe. So I just really want to know, is the situation that bad and can it be reversed?
I don't think the situation is bad in the sense that I think the 2020s could be a very good period for gas in Europe. We've got declining domestic production, which means we're going to need more gas, even if our demand declines, and we're going to need infrastructure to transport that gas to Europe. The problem is post-2030. And at the moment, we do not see decarbonisation of methane on a large scale being an option which anybody is pursuing vigorously. In other words, you know, where are the commercial scale CCS plants? Mm. Where is the commercial scale power to gas and steam reforming? We don't see this. Mm-hmm. We see people proposing projects and them not really moving forward. And this is a real decision for the industry. What I was trying to say in the first paper is, you know, don't think you can wait 10 years and then go into this, because by then other things will have moved past you. Yeah. If you really believe there's a large-scale future, you've got to do it in the next few years.
And has industry been listening to that? Are you getting feedback from your first paper, the industry minister?
What I'm afraid the feedback has been, in addition to the we don't believe in CCS because it's too expensive and we can't figure out how to organise it, the real problem in the industry on from another level is my management can't think past the next two shareholders meetings.
Yeah.
You know, it's no good me going into my management and saying, we need this project on CCS, which will not pay back till about 2030. They'll basically say, sorry, you know, we don't have room in our investment budget for that. So the industry, which has always been a long-term project and a long-term contract industry, has moved to short-term survival. What are we going to do for the shareholders in the next year or two? And in that kind of paradigm, you're not going to get decarbonisation.
So do we need different price levels? Is this a function of low gas prices, maybe probably driven by shale gas in the US, and low oil prices are now starting to creep up? Do we need to have higher energy prices to fulfil what we need as an industry?
The problem with higher energy prices, at least in the power generation sector, is it's simply going to advantage the low carbon sector. And I mean wind and solar backed by battery storage.
Yeah, yeah.
I don't personally think that nuclear is a large scale option in Europe these days. But the key thing that we all have to remember in the gas industry is 2011 to 2014 was a disastrous period for gas everywhere in the world, but especially in Europe. Mm-hmm. This is when we lost a vast amount of gas demand in Europe. Yeah. If we go back to those prices of $10 to $15 a million BTU, you know, above 30, 35 euros a megawatt hour, we are going to see that happen again. Mm-hmm. And this time that demand won't come back.
Yeah. Well, okay, well, let's move on to your second paper that you published very recently in December 2017, entitled The Challenges to the Future of Gas, Unburnable or Unaffordable. And I have to say, having read this paper, it was more optimistic, because you argue that outside of Europe countries, we will see gas demand growth based on gas replacing the more polluting fossil fuels such as coal and oil. So effectively, you know, why is this the case? You know, is it a matter of decarbonisation or is it an air quality issue?
Basically, outside Europe, until you get to countries like Japan and Australia, which is a little bit different, it is two things. It's an air quality issue, and the title unaffordable is the key.
Yeah.
In other words, in a lot of countries, you simply cannot sell gas at prices higher than $6 to $8, and in many, you can't sell gas at import prices higher than $5.
Mm-hmm.
And this way before we get to the question of carbon emissions and carbon reduction commitments, this is going to be what impacts the future of gas.
Right, okay. Now, is there a time limit on this? You know, COP21, it's got huge, long-distance achievable periods. And as you said, boards are sitting as being relatively short-minded. So I'm just wondering, you know, these targets kick in. Are they actually constraining long-term growth for that reason?
I don't think COP21 is constraining gas and will not constrain gas in most countries outside Europe until at least the mid-2030s and probably beyond that. And that's partly because of what I think of as the policy reaction. Mm-hmm. So, you know, there are two people tend to speak about China and India. As and these are very important countries for the future of energy and specifically the future of gas, but they are completely different.
Right.
And if we just take the short term, we see this winter that China is desperately short of gas because it has to move from coal to gas to improve air quality.
Yeah.
And it doesn't have enough gas to do that, and that has led to all kinds of problems.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the other thing that is very important about China is that China can afford to pay very high prices for gas, and is doing so.
Yeah.
Now, that prices above $10 a million BTU in China are no problem, especially for the coastal strip. Now, totally different situation in India.
Yeah.
In India, we see disastrous air quality in the cities. Doesn't seem to be a problem.
No.
I mean, it's obviously a problem for the people who live there.
Yeah.
But what we don't see is a massive government reaction or concern, or environmental riots, or anything like that.
Mm-hmm.
We also have much lower levels of affordability. And we don't really see gas, except possibly in the transport sector, being able to command a price above $5 a million.
But let me come to that, because you know this is a key conclusion of your second paper, which, by the way, can I recommend to everybody listen to this podcast, they download and read, because it's very good. You identify in this paper the disparity between the likely cost of gas from new LNG projects and this whole affordability issue which you've been talking about of these key future growth markets, where you know delivered prices of $6 to $8 per MMBTU just are not achievable in the markets when they're looking for $4 or $5, and then you go on and say that the gap will have to be closed. But you know, is this real? You know, the paper is very detailed on the prices that some markets can actually support.
What you see when you review wholesale prices over the decade to 2016 is that the world divides into two groups, essentially the OECD plus China, mm-hmm. which can afford prices $8 and above, and the rest of the world, which basically has never paid much more than $4 a million BTU yeah. wholesale prices. Mm-hmm. Now, what that tells you is, okay, some of these other countries and regions are going to get richer. Are they really going to get richer that they can pay more than $6?
Mm.
That doesn't seem very likely.
But what about if the oil price goes up? Or are you assuming the oil price is not going to go up?
No, I'm basically assuming that if the oil price goes up, that is going to be a decision for them in the transport sector.
Right.
It's not going to be a decision for them in the stationary sector, particularly the power generation sector.
Right.
And what I would say to project developers is, you got into this horrible mindset in 2011 to 14 that, oh, well, you know, this is what it costs to do my project and people are just going to have to pay because they've got no option. What you discovered post 2014 is, oh, yes, they did have an option, and the option was not to buy LNG and not to develop gas markets. And that is what you're going to continue to discover, that if you can only deliver LNG, and I'm talking about LNG because there are not that many big pipeline projects in the world, mm-hmm. if you can only deliver LNG at $8 and above, you will sterilise a very large part of your market in regions like Latin America, South Asia, maybe even Southeast Asia, Africa. All the new markets that you're relying on, basically what you're going to find is a very large part of that demand will not materialise because that price is too high.
So you're putting the solution in the hands of the project developers then? Technologically wise, technology cost reductions?
I mean, what I would say is it's got to be a value chain solution. So right. the upstream companies, the project developers, if they're not upstream companies, have got to figure out, look, we've got to deliver this stuff in most markets at no more than $8 and in some markets significantly less. And if we can't do that, then we shouldn't be doing these projects.
Okay, let's talk about the S word, should we?
Yep.
Subsidies.
Yep.
You know, in some regions, you know, gas subsidies have been an important part of the social contract. You know, are they the long-term solution to this whole cost-price issue, which you've been discussing?
Let's just be clear about when we talk about subsidies in this context.
Yes, you always like to define subsidies.
Because there's a lot of argy-bargy what is a subsidy.
Yeah.
My definition of subsidies is that you're delivering gas to customers who are not paying a price which covers the cost of that delivery. That's mm-hmm. my definition of subsidy.
Right, okay.
Now, the classic area where this is the case is the Middle East.
Yes.
And particularly the Gulf countries. And here you have something very different to what you see in Africa, Latin America, and some of these other regions.
Mm-hmm.
You have people who are basically rich people who can afford to pay for this stuff, but the social contract means that their governments subsidize gas, they subsidize power, they subsidize mm-hmm. water, they subsidize all the services.
Yep.
Now, they have been able to afford to do that in the past. The question is, to what extent can they afford to do that in the future as gas demand goes up, as gas imports go up, or the need to develop more expensive domestic gas materializes. And my view is that some countries, some governments, can afford to continue those subsidies on a large scale, but they will increasingly struggle to do that.
Mm-hmm.
Because in a lot of these countries, you've got prices, assuming customers actually pay anything, you've got prices which are $1.5, $2.5, $3, not much more than $4.
Yeah, exactly.
When people say that, oh, these countries are beginning to phase out subsidies, mostly that is in the gasoline sector and the electricity sector. It's not in the natural gas sector.
Well, it's interesting, this thing about another point you raised in your paper is kind of the gas demand growth switch from power, kind of what we call the traditional demand center, to industrial, residential and transport sectors. And you further note that these customers in these sectors are much more fragmented, and you know the old traditional long-term contract structure that's underpinned a lot of the chains may not be viable. So this again is challenging the business model, especially where buyers are located in smaller, low-income countries. So how are projects going to get financed?
Okay, well, I mean, let's just deal with the finance first.
Yeah, okay.
I'm a little bit impatient with the banking community in the sense that they seem to be taking the view, all the other parts of the business have to change, but we don't have to change. In other words, we're used to taking no risk financing blue chip companies selling on a monopoly basis to creditworthy customers. Well, guys, guess what? That world is over. So you are going to have to start to take some risk. It's not going to be as easy or as profitable as before. And if you want to still be in this business, you've got to change your business model. But the part of the business model which is perhaps more tricky is how do you move the value chain down to dispersed groups of customers, perhaps industrial customers that aren't so credit worthy. And my view on that is, you know, we've forgotten that we actually did do that in many of our countries. We did it because once we'd switched those guys to gas, they realized that if they didn't pay, they wouldn't get it.
Yep.
And if they didn't get it, they'd be out of business. But it's more complicated because, you know, the customers are more dispersed, the volumes are smaller. But it means you have to think in a different way in terms of your customer base.
So new models.
Exactly.
Yeah, exactly.
Exactly.
And that's something the Institute is actually working on at the moment, which is interesting. Let's just talk about then, you know, this whole fundamental question. If the gas kind of LNG or price, domestic price, doesn't work out, how are these kind of growth markets going to decarbonize, or are they not going to decarbonize? And decarbonize also, you know, talk about particulate as well.
Well, my view is it depends what you believe about renewables and battery storage. If you believe that renewables are already and will increasingly become just so cheap that it will be the obvious way of organizing, particularly a power generation sector, and you'll be able to back up with battery storage, which will also be very cheap, that solves at least 20% of your decarbonisation.
That's problem. A technology solution.
It's a technology solution, but a lot of people are claiming that that is already the case. I can't comment as to whether that, I just listen to what they're saying.
Right.
The problem is where you have a major heat load.
Yeah. Okay.
And also, what are you going to do about transport? And is that transport going to be electricity based or gas based?
Yeah.
So a lot of this is how fast will technologies go forward and how fast will cost reduction go forward.
Yeah.
But in the heat sector, it becomes much more difficult. And I would say that no one has really cracked low carbon heat yet.
Yeah.
I'm sure they will.
Yeah.
This is all about how long is it going to take and how much is it going to cost.
Yeah. Okay, well, look, let's kind of start wrapping this discussion up by, you know, because we have covered a lot of subjects over the last 25 minutes or so. And, you know, so basically, how do you think it's all going to end up? You know, what's the conclusion? Is gas going to just be a transition fuel for the next 10 to 20 years? And what's going to happen after that?
Okay, one of the things the points the second paper tries to make is, it's very, very difficult to make generalizations, even across one region. So, you know, people like to say, oh, this is happening in Europe. Well, nothing's happening in Europe. Different things are happening in different countries. And when you go to Asia, that's even more the case. If you go to Latin America, it's even more the case. So what you will have, I think, is certain countries where gas does substitute for coal. I think there'll be countries where it substitutes for renewables. In places like the Middle East, it will continue to substitute for oil.
Right.
Renewables and battery storage will come in, mainly in power generation. That'll be fine. But what we're really looking for is, what is the next generation? Is that hydrogen? And if it's hydrogen, do we make hydrogen by steam reforming methane and then transporting the hydrogen through the same pipes? Or do we make it through electrolysis of renewable energy?
Right.
And I think that's quite exciting, because what you could hypothesise is you would start with steam reforming methane. As electrolysis of renewables became more possible, you would augment the hydrogen augment the hydrogen supply via renewables. Mm-hmm. And so you have a meeting of fossil and non-fossil hydrogen. But this is, we're still a long, long way from all of this. Yeah. And this is why when people talk about 2050, my question is, you know, the fact that this might have happened by 2050, I'm fine with. But what I want to know is, does this happen in 2030 or does it happen in 2049? Because for the gas industry, we want to know, is it worth investing for the next 20 or 25 years, or have we only got another 10 years?
And you mentioned earlier on, you know, the frightening statement that many people sitting at the decision-making levels are only really looking for the next one or two shareholders meetings. So how do we square that?
Well, around the circle. Well, what a lot of people in the infrastructure business, that is the pipeline business, have to do is to think, look, in 2030, are we still going to be transporting the same amount of gas that we're transporting now? Yeah. And if we're not, are our networks finished? Essentially, they're basically stranded assets. Or can we convert them into doing something else? Yeah. And this is the main asset they have.
Yeah.
So this is a big deal for them. For upstream companies, a lot of their answer is, oh, well, if Europe doesn't want gas, we'll just sell it to China. I mean, I don't think that really works as a business model. But when you look at the amount of demand that China has, you can see why they think like that.
Interesting. Well, Jonathan, thank you so much for your time. I have to say, I've really enjoyed our conversation. And this certainly builds upon the two papers on the future of gas that can be found at our website, www.oxfordenergy.org. And as I said earlier on, I really urge you to read those in full. And on the same website, you can find all our podcasts in the multimedia folder and other papers published by the Institute. I hope you've really enjoyed this, listen to this podcast, and thank you and goodbye to everyone.